They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
It's a new year, fresh start and all that, right? For the markets, maybe not. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the studios at Colorado Public Radio in Denver, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, January 1st. Happy New Year. With 2018 now in the rearview mirror, it's official. It was the worst year for the U.S. stock market since the 2008 financial crisis, with all three major indices down for the year. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour joins me from our bureau in New York to help make sense of the economic year gone by and what's ahead in 2019. Hi, Sabri.
Hi, Amy.
Though we've been in a really, really long bull market, the end of the year was kind of rough for the markets. Talk about what happened.
Well, 2018 kicked off with a bang. We had just gotten this major tax cut oriented mostly towards businesses. Then in February, there was this major increase in government spending, almost $300 billion. And this all was, whether it was intended this way or not, this was stimulus for the economy. It was a lead foot on the gas pedal. And so for several quarters, the economy grew at 4%, 3.5%. It was great.
So a great start. And then?
And then there's the and then number two. The president started escalating trade conflicts, tariffs on steel, tariffs on aluminum, threatened to blow up NAFTA, tariffs on Chinese products, tariffs on more Chinese products, threatened tariffs on cars and auto parts. You mentioned the stock market. This is what is clearly troubling the stock market, because when you don't know what's going to happen with tariffs and trade, it means not only do you not know how much prices are going to rise, but if you're a multinational business, then you do not know what to do with your supply chains.
And that uncertainty continues going into 2019. What kinds of things should we be looking forward to or maybe bracing ourselves for?
First of all, that government spending, it's going to actually keep driving the economy further into this year. There's usually a lag between when spending is passed and when it kicks in. But how will the economy react when it subsides? We don't know. What will happen to trade? Will we work something out with China? Will tariffs on China rise further? Will they retaliate further? Will we get auto tariffs? All of those questions, all of them, are also big questions at the Federal Reserve, which has to figure out, given all these variables, how much more to raise interest rates. If they overshoot, we will get a recession. If they undershoot, we could get inflation. So, you know, a lot of people are actually wondering if we'll get a recession in 2019. I have to emphasize that the fundamentals of the economy are still looking very strong right now. But with all of this uncertainty, people wonder.
And we've been talking about mostly the U.S. economy, but what about internationally?
You know, a lot of what happens in the U.S. affects the international economy and vice versa. And depending on what the Federal Reserve feels it needs to do with interest rates and what European central banks decide to do and what Japan decides to do, we could see more distress in emerging markets. You know, you got to remember that interest rates help determine currency values. And this is a time when rising interest rates have been pulling capital out of vulnerable and dysfunctional emerging markets, Turkey and Argentina last year. So we should keep an eye on that. Then there's Brexit. The UK is the world's fifth largest economy. March 29th, they are leaving the EU and all the rules governing goods and services evaporate. Joe Bruswellis is a chief economist at RSM US. He said he thinks people are really underestimating the risks here.
Essentially, walls will go up all around the island economy. It will affect everything from transportation, the shipments of food, fuel, and medicine. And this is a real significant risk.
He also pointed out to me when I talked to him that German, Japanese, and French economies all contracted in the third quarter. Commodity markets are softening. He says that's a warning sign we may not get sustained global growth at a high level. Another item to watch, China, what happens with its economy. It's applied stimulus to counteract pressure from the trade conflict and an economic slowdown that was already in the works. We'll see how they pull out of that. So, I mean, big picture here, we have a lot of things to worry about this 2019.
And a very happy new year to you too, Sabri. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Marketplace's Sabri Benishour. No trading today, so it's a great time to review the year's big winners and losers. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Sabri talked about tariffs as one of the big uncertainties weighing on the markets. As of today, there are some tariffs around the world that are actually falling. Six Pacific Rim nations, including Japan, Australia, and Mexico, are lowering barriers for a number of products and services, with five other countries set to join in once the deal is formally ratified. Notably absent from the party, the United States. Marketplace's Justin Ho has more on what this new trade agreement could mean for American farmers.
This trade agreement's name is a mouthful, the CPTPP. The CP stands for Comprehensive and Progressive, and those last three letters might sound familiar.
Effectively, the CPTPP is the Trans-Pacific Partnership that's moved forward without the United States.
That's John Newton, chief economist of the American Farm Bureau Federation. President Trump abandoned the TPP 3 days into his presidency. The Farm Bureau estimates that lost American farmers an additional $4 billion a year in income, nearly half of that from selling more beef and pork.
Certainly when you think about some of those Pacific Rim countries and their diets, you think about pork and beef and poultry. Those are markets that are very important markets for U.S. producers.
By remaining outside this new deal, the U.S. isn't just leaving money on the table. American farmers are now less competitive when they try to sell their products in CPTPP countries. Gary Huffpower at the Peterson Institute says, take Japan, for example.
Japan is the third largest economy in the world.
And it's always protected its agricultural market. But now it's reducing tariffs on imports from a couple of agricultural powerhouses.
Australia is a very strong agricultural producer, as is, of course, New Zealand, a smaller country. And they will have good access to the Japanese market, which the U.S. won't have.
President Trump has said he prefers bilateral trade agreements. Japan and the U.S. agreed to start negotiating one back in September. But Huffpower says even in the best-case scenario, that agreement won't be ready for a year. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Did your inbox fill up with end-of-year appeals for nonprofit donations? We'll look at what changes in the tax code mean for you and your charity of choice. Coming up tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report. One of the best things about being a business reporter is getting a close-up look at the many different ways people make a living. If you've been listening to our series, How to Be a Blank, you've heard from a park ranger, a music supervisor for the movies, a dog photographer. Yes, that's a thing. Today, we're featuring arguably one of the most important jobs out there. Here's what it's like to be an emergency room doctor.
My name is Zahir Basrai, and I'm an emergency medicine physician practicing here in Los Angeles. As a kid, I remember watching the show ER with George Clooney kind of running around. And that was kind of my first introduction to what ER is. As a pre-medical student, I was lucky enough to shadow an emergency medicine physician, and it was at that time that I was first introduced to the energetic, chaotic, amazing environment that is the emergency department. There are a couple of things that you need to have in order to be a good emergency medicine physician. One of them is the ability to multitask. It's something that's acquired after years of training. But the idea is you're seeing as many patients as possible, as quickly as possible. And during that time, you're constantly being interrupted by nurses or by techs. And then you have to be able to bring yourself back and kind of refocus and reprioritize what needs to happen in your emergency department to make things flow. I think grit is a really important thing as well. Emotionally, you sometimes have to deliver really hard news to families, and you have to be able to compartmentalize this in order to be able to step out of those emotional situations and be able to resume the practice and handle the demands of the department. I think the best part about emergency medicine is that ability to form an instant connection with your patient. You don't have time to develop rapport when there is an emergency, so you have to be able to form an instant connection with them. And it's that bond, that human bond, that keeps me coming back to work every day.
Thanks to Dr. Basarai for writing in about his work in the ER. You can see a photo of him and tell us about your own awesome job at marketplace.org. Coming up,
a number of the students I interviewed said their fraternity is sort of like a second family to them.
The pros and cons of Greek life on campus, but first, let's do the numbers. The markets are closed today for the New Year's holiday. Looking back on 2018, it was a year to forget, with stocks posting their worst year in a decade. For the year, the Dow was off 5.6%, the NASDAQ was down 3.8%, the S&P 500 lost 6.2%. 2018 was downright brutal for big tech stocks. Facebook shares finished the year down 40% from their mid-year peak. Shares in Google parent Alphabet fell by 19% over the same period. Apple was down 32% during the fourth quarter of the year that just ended. But for 164 smaller tech outfits, 2018 was a great year because it's when they brought in their first $1 million in revenue on Apple's App Store. Another 88 companies are in their first million through Google Play. You are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. Early this morning, NASA achieved a first in space exploration. The New Horizons probe conducted a successful flyby of an icy space rock that's 4 billion miles from Earth, called Ultima Thule. It's the most distant object ever explored by a human-made spacecraft. Meanwhile, any day now, the Chinese are likely to accomplish another first, a little closer to home, by landing a probe on the dark side of the moon. Marketplace's Andy Euler looks at why China's spending billions on space exploration.
When the Chinese decided they wanted to land something on the far side of the moon, they called Jim Head. He worked on the U.S. Apollo program in the late 1960s. Now he teaches planetary science at Brown University, and he was excited to help the Chinese figure out where the probe should land.
Going to the far side of the moon is really a big deal because basically we've been unable to do that.
Head says the Chinese are trying to lead the world in space travel for the same reasons the United States and Soviet Union wanted to do it 50 years ago.
These kinds of efforts are really good demonstrations of technological capability, leadership, and organizational skills. This is really important for national pride and national prestige.
The Chinese have been investing heavily in space travel for a couple of decades. China became the third country to send humans into orbit in 2003. Beijing doesn't release numbers on how much it spends on its space program, but industry analysts put the number at about $8 billion a year. That's about half of NASA's annual budget. But Gregory Kalacki at the Union of Concerned Scientists says the Chinese reckon they'll get a lot of propaganda bang for their space travel buck.
I once had a person from the Chinese space program explain to me that one of their, you know, human spaceflight missions doesn't cost them as much as like a mile of subway in Beijing.
Some of the money is made available to the more than 60 private space companies that have sprung up around China. The goal is, in the not-too-distant future, to send a mission to Mars, and the Chinese are planning to partner with other countries to get there. Stephen Clark runs the website spaceflightnow.com. He says the probe set to land on the moon this week is already an example of international collaboration.
It carries an instrument from Sweden, an instrument from German University, and the communications relay station that they launched carries a Dutch instrument and also launched with a couple of microsatellites from Saudi Arabia.
But nothing from the U.S. That's in part because NASA is prohibited by law from partnering with the Chinese space program in an effort to protect national security secrets. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
We're at the tail end of a record-breaking retail season that was especially good for online retailers. According to MasterCard, online sales in November and December were more than 5% higher than last year. And as Americans buy more and more online, we're also starting to depend more on online product reviews, which can be a minefield. How do you weed out the fake reviews? How reliable are the star ratings? Gabby Del Valle wrote about how to make the best use of reviews for Vox. Gabby, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You say that to get the most out of online reviews, we can't really just look at the star ratings. We actually have to read them. So what are some things you found to look out for when reading through those reviews?
It depends what website you're looking at. If you're looking at Amazon, for example, they kind of sort them by most helpful, which is actually very helpful. You should look for things like length, for detail, not just a star rating.
So are the star ratings totally irrelevant, or can they be helpful as well?
The thing that happens with reviews is that products that have a lot of ratings and are also very highly rated get kind of pushed to the top of the search on websites like Amazon. Then more people buy those products and more people rate those products. So it kind of is a cycle. It's not that the products with more reviews are necessarily better. They just are in the right place.
You write about this whole industry of fake reviews. How can you tell?
The short answer is that you kind of can't. One study showed people real reviews and fake reviews and found that they could only spot them half the time, like with the accuracy of a coin toss. And that's especially true if the reviews are written by people and not by algorithms. But you should look for things like length, like detail, But again, those things are also present in fake reviews sometimes. So be a little skeptical, but not too skeptical.
So we thought it would be fun to read through some actual Amazon reviews with you and interpret them. We found the Gorilla Grip Bath Pillow on Amazon. It's an inflatable bath pillow because I guess some people like to have their heads cushioned when they bathe. And here's one review that stands out. Quote, "This bath pillow is wonderful. I had the blow-up Terry pillow and ditched it for this, and I am so glad I did. This pillow is extremely comfortable and the best pillow I have ever tried. My tub is curved, and there was no problem with it conforming to my tub. The suction cups hold very well. If you want to remove it, I recommend peeling the suction cups away with your fingernail to prevent ripping the pillow." This is very specific. "I highly recommend this bath pillow. It is the best I have tried. You will not be disappointed." So what's your best guess whether this is a real review or a fake?
I think it's real. There are pictures of it in someone's house, which I guess you could fake that, but it requires effort to do that. It's marked as a verified purchase, which means that the person actually bought it through Amazon and had it shipped to them. So it really goes into a lot of detail about the product. That seems hard to fake.
Yeah, and also the recommendation about peeling it away with your fingernail might be helpful to someone who has trouble removing bath pillows.
Yeah. And or just somebody who's used a lot. This person apparently previously had the blow up Terry pillow and they ditched it. So it seems real.
So stay away from that one. All right. There was a negative review rated 1 star. This one's only a sentence long, not a verified purchase. The headline is, "I would not recommend this product or buy it again." Quote, "If possible, I would rate this no stars. Pillows started to leak after third use. I would not recommend this product or buy it again. Period."
I don't know. The fact that it's not verified makes me a little hesitant. But again, I guess they could have bought it in a different store and then reviewed it on Amazon. But the bigger effect of reviews like this, whether they're positive or negative, if they don't have a lot of detail, they will still affect the average review.
So the effect of a review like this is it does affect the aggregate star rating, which people do pay attention to, right?
Yeah, exactly. So if there were like 100 reviews like this one, they would affect the aggregate even if you don't ever read them or if they don't help you.
So the takeaway, read the reviews, take them with a grain of salt, figure out what's useful in them, but certainly be a little bit skeptical.
Yeah, be a little bit skeptical and definitely look past the star rating to the details.
Gabby Del Valle, reporter at Vox.com. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy.
This time of year, parents and students all over the country are making choices about college. It's one of the biggest investment decisions they'll face in their lifetimes. Many application deadlines fall today or sometime this month. And once the admissions results are in, many students face another decision, whether to go Greek. Journalist Alexandra Robbins followed two real-life fraternity brothers for a whole school year to get a picture of Greek life today. Her forthcoming book is called Fraternity, an inside look at a year of college boys becoming men. Alexandra, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
I think a lot of us have images in our minds of what fraternities look like. I mean, I grew up in a college town. There was a house we knew to avoid because a stereo might come flying out of the window. And that's not really an exaggeration. What was the biggest surprise for you in following these two students for a year?
Well, you know, it's not so much as a surprise as I was trying to look at this from a different point of view. I didn't want to write what everybody sees in the media because that's just sort of a general stereotype. People don't usually think about fraternities this way, but it's a major reason they continue to thrive. When you send your son to college, he might be nervous or a little lost or unsure of how to make friends. Healthy fraternities can actually be comfort zones for these teenagers, especially on campuses that don't have other resources specifically for young men. A number of the students I interviewed said their fraternity is sort of like a second family to them.
This is big business. I mean, you write in the book that fraternities and sororities control at least $3 billion in student housing. How does that relate to the power these organizations have on campus?
Greek organizations are very powerful on campus. They kind of occupy this unique position where they are both dependent on universities and separate from them. And they are big businesses. Predominantly white fraternities and sororities do own at least $3 billion in college student housing, and they manage several hundred million dollars in annual revenue and foundation assets.
Predominantly white. That's an issue that you talk about in the book, the lack of diversity.
When groups are diverse, they are less likely to succumb to groupthink, which is what can get some fraternities in trouble. But some chapters are cost prohibitive in the predominantly white groups. I don't think it spoils the plot of the book to share that Jake, a freshman I followed through the recruitment and pledging, was really disappointed when a minority guy who was otherwise doing great in the pledge process had to drop out because he couldn't afford dues. I think diversity is an area in which fraternities could improve, and doing that would ultimately make them much healthier.
You mentioned the dues. I mean, how much does it cost to be a member of a fraternity these days? It's not just the dues, but the dress code and in some cases the gear they need for activities?
Yeah, there's an enormous range for dues. It varies by the campus. It varies by the chapter. I talked to guys who paid just a few hundred per semester, and there were guys who paid $1,000 a semester for social dues alone, and that didn't include other fees and payments to nationals.
You know, the image in some ways is justified. I mean, the fact is that fraternities do wind up in the headlines for things like sexual assault, racist or sexist or homophobic behavior. Are those just, you know, individual bad apples, or did you find something, you know, inherently rotten in the system that allows this to happen?
Actually, my researcher and I conducted an analysis of every negative incident we could find publicly reported online between January 2010 and June 2018. And what we ended up finding is that the percentage of fraternity chapters that we see in the headlines is actually pretty low. Hmm. About two-thirds of fraternities are not the ones that we see negatively depicted in the news. Maybe even more if you count the multicultural fraternities, the service fraternities, and all the other kinds of fraternities out there that we don't often hear about.
When you talk about the bad behavior that does happen, what are some things that colleges and the larger national organizations themselves can do to try to mitigate that?
Some fraternities can bring out the best in students. Some can bring out the worst. But schools can provide more resources to young men to show them that they don't have to fall within this box of what's been called toxic masculinity, that there are other ways to express masculinity and other ways of becoming an adult than what stereotypes and societal expectations might suggest.
All right. Alexandra Robbins wrote Fraternity, an inside look at a year of college boys becoming men. It's out later this year. Alexandra, thanks.
Thank you.
This final note, today marks the first big release of copyrighted works into the public domain in more than 20 years, including works from 1923 by Robert Frost, Edith Wharton, and Cecil B. DeMille. Even more exciting, though, may be what's to come in the years ahead if Congress doesn't intervene. Next January, according to Ars Technica, we'll get George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, the year after that, The Great Gatsby, and then on January 1st, 2024, Steamboat Willie, the first appearance of Mickey Mouse, who is in some ways responsible for ever longer copyright protection. When Walt Disney's first animated short was created in 1928, it had copyright protection for 56 years, but Disney has lobbied for longer and longer extensions and is widely expected to do so again. Okay, we gotta go. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Tony Wagner, and Joanne Griffith. Ben Hefcoat is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Satara Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. And special thanks today to Joe Pestovich, Mike Rick, Peter Kramer, and Brady McNellis at Colorado Public Radio. I'm Amy Scott. Happy New Year, everybody.
This is APM.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.